Okay, tonight's talk, I'm going to talk about a very basic subject of Buddhism, because I like these basic subjects myself. I'm going to talk about morality tonight, and I was thinking about this what I was going to talk about tonight, and I was thinking about this subject of morality, and I felt really inspired. Even though it's basic, it's very fundamental. I felt inspired, and I think I felt inspired because I know this is very much relates to our everyday practice, to how we have to, the things that we have to overcome, the things that we have to do in every single day, basically. And it's true in the monastery, and it's probably even more true in lay life, because you have much more interaction with other people, and much more chances of slipping up when it comes to morality and doing the right thing and the good thing here. And when I felt inspired by that, by those thoughts, I thought, well, maybe people here as well might feel inspired by this. So I thought it might be a good thing to talk about. Now, the thing about morality and Buddhism, and what I want to start off with when it comes to morality here, I want to talk about some of those basic things in Buddhism that come prior to the rules of morality that we often hear about. We hear about the five precepts, we hear about the eight precepts, and we hear about all these kind of various rules that we have to keep. But the beautiful thing in Buddhism is that there is actually something prior to that. There is actually a rule or a way to decide how and what is moral in the first place. There is a way of looking at the world to decide on moral rules. And of course, this is extremely useful. Because if we don't know what to do in a particular situation, if we then go back to this basic moral rule, then we can actually find out what is moral in a particular context. Go back to the basic foundation, and you can decide for yourself what actually is moral and what isn't. And there is two ways that the Buddha talked about this. And the first way is, he said that there is such a thing as motivation, or a basis on which we do actions in life. And this basis can either be wholesome or it can be unwholesome. The unwholesome basis in life is things like, it's basically said as three or four things, he said it is. It is greed, hatred, and delusion. And sometimes he also added fear. So these are the four bases in life for unwholesome actions. On the other side, you also have the basis or the roots of wholesome actions, which are the exact opposites. So instead of greed, you have non-greed or generosity. Instead of hatred, you have loving kindness and compassion towards beings. Instead of delusion, you have wisdom. So this is the opposite. And that is often important to also talk about the opposite. I was reading a book recently, and somebody was complaining that in Buddhism, we always talk about the negative things, but we actually forget to talk about the positive things. And the thing is that the Buddha, when you read the suttas, when you read his discourses, you realize that he always talked about both sides of the coin, because this is basically two sides of the same coin, the positive and the negative. So morality has a negative aspect in a sense, there are things you want to avoid, but it also has a positive aspects, the things that you want to do, the things promote goodness in yourself, and also happiness and goodness in others. So this is then a way, this looking at this greed, hatred, and delusion is a way of knowing in the present moment whether you are doing something good, something wholesome, or whether you're doing something bad. What is your mind state like when you do a particular action? Are you motivated by something good, something positive? Or are you motivated by these negative tendencies of mind? And straight away, if you're feeling irritated or angry or upset at something, you know that whatever action are based on that is going to tend to be unwholesome, is going to be bad. So straight away you know, okay, here is a barrier. I should be careful here. I should be very careful what happens because my mind is overcome by a negative state. Or if desire is very powerful in the mind, desire is the same thing again. You know it's very likely to lead to something unwholesome if desire is a very powerful force in the mind at the time. And you also know the opposite. If you are have a sense of compassion and loving kindness towards people around you, you know that you can be at ease and you can do almost anything. It's almost impossible to do anything wrong when you have that beautiful mind state of compassion and loving kindness towards other beings. And you will feel that yourself. You will feel at ease with yourself. And whatever you do is going to be good and wholesome. And you will know that when you do it. The last one, and this is the most difficult one, and that is this factor of delusion in the mind. And delusion is something, unfortunately, we cannot see directly. Because delusion, by its very nature, is a force in the mind which means that we cannot see clearly. Because you cannot see clearly, you cannot know that you are deluded at the time. It's impossible to actually know that. So it makes it very hard. In fact, it makes it so difficult that you cannot actually know ever really fully until you become fully enlightened whether your action is fully wholesome or not. It's actually impossible to know that because of this delusion aspect there. And it's the same thing also to some extent with if you are having a lot of desire in the mind or a lot of irritation, anger in the mind. Because of those aspects in the mind, it tends to distort the way we look at the world, tends to distort things. We see things in a different way. And you know what it often can be like if you feel upset at something, you feel, I really need to say this, I really need to do this. And you do it, and later on, when the upset has disappeared, you think, why on earth did I do that? And you know the reason, and you know in retrospect what happened there. What happened was the mind was distorted because of that negativity in the mind. So because of this, because of delusion, and because of the danger of greed and also of anger, there is another way that the Buddha taught by which we can make moral decisions. And I'm sure you all know about this already. And this is maybe a more practical way of deciding whether something is moral or not. And this is by asking yourself whether a particular action of body, speech, or mind is going to be to your own benefit or to your own disadvantage. Is it going to be other people's benefit or to other people's disadvantage? Is it going to be the benefit or the disadvantage of both others and yourself? And you know that an action is good, is wholesome, when it is for the benefit of both, or at least for the benefit of either yourself or others. And the reverse is going to be unwholesome if it is either for somebody else's disadvantage, your own disadvantage, or the disadvantage of both. And this is a very, very useful, in my opinion at least, way of finding out whether something is moral or something is immoral. And some of the most difficult questions in life, some of the most difficult moral dilemmas that we are faced with sometimes, things like abortion, euthanasia, stem cell research, and all these things. If you use this simple technique and ask yourself, who is it hurting? Is it hurting anybody? You can actually come very close to deciding for yourself whether this is going to be a moral act or an immoral act, whether it's going to be bad karma or good karma. There is more to it than just this. There are also other fundamental principles in Buddhism you can use to decide whether something is moral or immoral. But this is the most basic one and the most important one. So just starting from this point, you can actually come to a lot of conclusions about some of the most difficult moral dilemmas in life. So in this way, it's very useful. It's a great guide that you can use in everyday life to decide whether things are good, bad, or maybe neither. So having said that, I'm now going to actually talk about some specific moral questions. They're going to be very standard and very basic Buddhist moral questions, because I think these things are very important. But first of all, you might ask, well, why, if we have this basic rule that if you do something good for yourself and it's good for others, then you know it's moral, and it's immoral if it's bad for yourself and others, why isn't this enough? Why do we need these five precepts? What's the point of having all these rules and regulations when this basic idea is really sufficient? And you can summarize the good life or the good Buddhist life with kindness. If you can be a kind and a good person, then basically you have basically done it. That's it. That's what it's all about. And the reason why we actually need rules, and why guidelines like the five precepts or the eight precepts or something I'm going to talk about afterwards, which is called like the 10 courses of action. This is the most detailed description of virtue in that the Buddha taught. The reason we need these things is because we get deluded and because we get overcome by anger, desires, which distort our perceptions and views, like I just talked about a few minutes ago. Because of that, suddenly you become so overwhelmed by something that you cannot see straight anymore. You can't see what is good, what is beneficial, and what isn't. But then you remember, the five precepts. This is what I should be doing. And there, when your mind is really not functioning normally anymore, it's going being distorted and you can't see straight, then these rules come in very, very handy because they keep you on the straight and narrow, so to speak. So that is why we have rules in Buddhism, in my opinion. But if you are fully enlightened, you don't actually need these rules anymore, because then morality comes naturally. So I'm going to talk about something the Buddha called the 10 courses of action. These 10 courses of action are divided into bodily action, verbal action, and mental action. And this is a classification of morality that the Buddha used quite frequently, quite often in the suttas, in his discourses. And it's very broad, because we're talking about 10 aspects here of morality. And they overlap largely with the 5 precepts, except that you don't find the alcohol drinking in these 10 courses of action. So I'm going to bring in alcohol as well as I go through this. The first of these, the first classification here is bad bodily action. And the first one of bad bodily action is, of course, not killing living beings or injuring living beings. And the opposite, the wholesome thing, of course, is to support living beings, to help life, to be compassionate, to have loving kindness, and to support beings in distress and that have difficulty. Support life, basically. This is the opposite. Always think of these things as two sides of the same coin. This one interesting principle, which I maybe should mention straight away, you will see that the Buddha always taught this first. This comes at the very top of the list. And you also know for the 5 precepts, you know the first of the 5 precepts is always not to kill, not to harm living beings. Now, why is it that this comes at the top of the list? Is this just random? Are the 5 precepts just a random order? Or is there a significance to the particular sequence here? And one of the things you will find when you start to know the Buddha's teachings very well is that the Buddha's teaching is always a gradual teaching. He said that one of the difficult things about giving a talk is always the talk should always be gradual. It should start at an elementary level, and then it should actually rise up. So you will see typically in the sutta, as you will see, he starts off with the most basic things of virtue, and then he gradually moves up to full enlightenment. So everything the Buddha says, basically, there is a gradation there, and there's a reason for that. That particular sequence. No sequence is random. And the sequence that we are seeing here basically means that the killing of living beings is the most serious kind of bad bodily action that we can do. And the support of life and the compassion towards living beings is therefore also the most powerful of the good karma and the goodness that we can do. This is the importance here. So how can we increase our compassion for living beings? How can we increase our ability not to destroy life and not to harm life? And I think for most of us, there's probably very few in here who have ever killed anybody before, any person. So I'm not going to talk too much about not killing human beings. But certainly when it comes to animals, our society is full of killing of animals. And it's very difficult to find anybody. Even good Buddhists will sometimes get so irritated with a mosquito that they go wham and they slam the mosquito. Because this mosquito has only come here to trouble me, to drink my blood, and they give me an itch on top of that. So it's pretty bad news. And of course, the difficulty with a mosquito and the difficulty with animals in general is that it's difficult to see the human qualities in these beings. The reason that it's quite easy to be compassionate toward other humans is because we recognize some of us ourselves in those other humans. But with animals, it can be very difficult. With some animals, it's more easy, but with some animals, it's very hard. And I think a mosquito is a classical case where it's difficult to really make any kind of connection with a mosquito. You can't really feel its suffering. You can't understand that it's getting a hard time when you actually squash it on your arm. So the important thing to try with killing is to try to use this word anthropomorphize other beings, living beings. Anthropomorphize means finding like the human qualities in animals, even in insects, even in anything. And once you can see those human qualities in there, once you can see that there's actually much less distinction between us and animals than you might think, then of course compassion becomes so much more natural, and it becomes so much more difficult to kill that being afterwards. So the trick here is to see the qualities in this being, see that there is hurt there, see that there is suffering, and then when you see that, your compassion will naturally by itself increase, and you will be able to keep this kind of precept much more deeply, much more profoundly. So how do we do this? And the first thing, one thing which I have always looked, some things I like to look at is like scientific evolution in recent years. And it's very fascinating to see what science has found out about animals over the last few decades. And I have certainly read articles about, take for example the great apes. It used to be the case that we thought that animals can just be slaughtered. Animals are completely distinct from humans, got nothing to do with us. But of course now we realize that there is a lot of animals who are very, very close to humans. I think scientists have found out that chimpanzees, for example, they have organized structures in social units in their societies. They use tools. It used to be thought that what made humans humans was that we could use tools and no other animals could use tools. Then it was discovered that chimpanzees could use tools. And of course, once we start to see these things, we see that there is a lot in common here with human society and chimpanzees. And I also heard of the great apes who were found to be very intelligent. In fact, so intelligent that they scored higher than some human beings. And this is remarkable, isn't it? You can certainly see here that this gorilla, whatever, is actually, in one sense, more human than this other human being that we have to deal with. More intelligent, more bright, more capable of understanding what's happening around it and what's going on. And suddenly the barriers really, really start to break down. And of course then, you also understand that there are other animals who are almost as intelligent, almost as human as the great apes. You have animals like elephants, and maybe even further down the scale, maybe pigs, and maybe some of the pets that we have can be quite intelligent. And pets is also a great way of seeing the humanity or seeing the emotions in animals, because I'm sure that all of you have pets, will realize that animals have emotions very, very much like human beings. Not so long ago, we had a cat that died in the monastery. We usually had three cats in the monastery. One of the cats died, and it was obvious that the other cat, one of the other cats, became very sad. You could see it didn't really want to eat anymore. It looked kind of depressed, was sort of walking around with its head hanging a bit. There was no kind of jump in it anymore. And it was obviously sad, obviously grieving the loss of its companion. And you can see there the human emotions. You can see it in the kangaroos in the monastery. I see it all the time. First of all, you can see the desires in kangaroos. I usually throw out food to them, whatever is left in my bowl after the meal. I throw it out to the kangaroos. And you can see the desire. They come from afar to get this human food. When it used to just eat in grass, human food is, wow, there's something really nice. Even if it's just rice, it's amazing. So they come from afar. You can see the desire there, the craving, just like we have for good food. You can see the ill will when they start fighting over the food. You can see sometimes the love and the empathy that, for example, a mother kangaroo has towards her joey. You can see how they stroke each other, how they lick each other, how they look after each other. And you can see there are beautiful emotions there and bad emotions, just like in human beings. So thinking like this, you start to see that the difference between animals and humans isn't that great. It's a matter of degree, certainly not a matter of absolute. There isn't like an absolute barrier there. It's like a continuous spectrum, starting from high, going down. But when it gets more difficult is when you get to small animals like insects, when you get to things like fish. I remember myself when I was a teenager, I would fish. And when I think back, I was wondering sometimes, well, why? How could I actually fish in those days? What was that drove me to fishing? And I realize now that the reason that I was able to fish or because I didn't have any connection with this fish. It was like a cold animal. You look in it, look it in the eye, and it's very different looking a fish in the eye, looking a kangaroo in the eye. Fish, there's not really sense there that this being has any emotions or anything here. And I think that was what the reason why I could fish, because I could make absolutely no connection here, or at least very small connection with this animal here. But of course, when I think back, if I had been a little bit wiser, I would have been able to see that this animal is obviously suffering. It is wriggling on the hook. It's trying to get off. Obviously, it doesn't like this. It's very, very clear. And it doesn't take that much insight to understand that you're actually causing suffering for this animal. And I know that also recently there have been animal experiments on fish which show that there actually is real pain suffered by this fish when they get a hook hooked in their mouth. And then you can start again to empathize with them. You see that there is more similarity there than you might at first think. And then you come to the mosquito. What about the mosquito? What does the mosquito do? To us, it looks like just an irritant. Somebody come to drink our blood. We'd like to have a blood for ourselves. Thank you very much. But here comes somebody who actually wants to take your blood. But of course, for the mosquito, it's just a matter of I need something to propagate myself. Apparently, it's mostly female mosquitoes who drink blood so that they can actually have offspring afterwards. And for them, it's just a matter of nature. They don't realize that we are creatures who actually are hurting or at least scratching because of this. They just do their little thing, and this is just nature for them. And they need this blood to keep themselves going. For them, it's just like a meal. And of course, we also realize that even mosquitoes don't like to die. If you try to squeeze a mosquito, squeeze its leg, or you try to do something with it, it runs away. It starts to fly. It flies off. And there's obviously there a reaction just like us. Like all beings, even the mosquito actually wants to live. And you will see that even with the tiniest insects, they run for their life if you try to do something bad with them. So in this way, we can anthropomorphize. We can actually put these human qualities onto the most, what we think are the most unpleasant creatures, and look at them in a new light. And then we can actually get compassion going for these creatures. And there comes a point when you don't want to squash the mosquito anymore. There comes even a point when you're quite happy to just allow that mosquito maybe to drink your blood and say, okay, maybe it will itch a little bit. Not such a big deal there. There's always a few things happening in the monastery. We have lots of kangaroos in the monastery here. And one thing which I remember very well to this day is one day I was sitting on my walking path. We have these nice walking paths outside our huts in the monastery, for those of you who have been there and seen it. And I was sitting outside eating my daily meal. And as I'm sitting there, this kangaroo comes in on the other side of the walking path. And it sort of starts walking towards me. This path is about 18 meters long, so it comes in about 18 meters from me. And it starts walking towards me, and it seems very determined, like very, very direct line towards my bowl, in fact. It keeps walking and walking and walking until it's standing completely next to me. And then it starts looking into my bowl. And at this point, I'm getting a bit concerned. And then it starts to lower its head down, and quickly I put my arms over my bowl, because I'm not yet prepared to actually share my lunch with a kangaroo. And I thought this would surely deter the kangaroo. When I put my arms in the way, surely this is enough. But it wasn't enough. At this point, the kangaroo takes out this little forearm, the little small arms, places on my hands, and tries to pull my hands apart. Can you believe that? I was really, at this point, I was absolutely flabbergasted. I couldn't believe a kangaroo would ever do such a thing. So I decide that there's only one thing to do, and it is to get up. And I actually get up, and I literally have to push this kangaroo off my walking path. And then when it's finally off the walking path, I can sit down again and have my meal. So I, in retrospect, I sometimes think maybe I should actually let the kangaroo have a meal with me. Maybe I should actually allow it to eat from my bowl. But I'm not daring enough to do that sort of thing. But maybe that would be a nice thing to do. But anyway, it shows you what sometimes compassion can do and what kindness can do. Because in a monastery, we always treat the kangaroos very nicely. We always give them the scraps left over from our bowls. There's no reason why we shouldn't. It's left over anyway. and we treat them well, and sometimes they become this friendly when you treat them really well. And in one sense, even though I was a little bit surprised that it was so greedy for the food, I was actually very happy that that happened, because it showed a level of trust in a wild animal which I had never thought possible in my entire life. So I was quite happy about this, and I felt a kind of sense of joy that this actually occurred. And I remember another story I read not so long ago, and this was a story from a zoo. And there was an enclosure where all the chimpanzees were in, and there was a pond there. And one of these chimpanzees, for some reason, fell into the pond. And there was all this human being standing around, looking down to the pond. And apparently, I don't know if it's true for all chimpanzees, but this particular chimpanzee could not swim. And this man was looking at this chimpanzee, and this chimpanzee was looking at the man. And the man said afterwards that, "I could see this look in this eyes of the chimpanzee, but isn't anybody going to help me? I'm sinking. I'm dying here. Isn't somebody going to do something?" And of course, the man straight away felt this contact with the chimpanzee, this emotional contact. So he dove into the dam, grabbed hold of the chimpanzee, and pulled it out of the lake, out of this little pond. So he rescued this animal, which he had never met before. He was just a stranger in the zoo. Pulled it out of the mud, out of certain death. And this, of course, is so beautiful. And this is the kind of action, wholesome bodily action, where we actually save animals and save life, rather than do the opposite. So that is really all I think I want to say about the first course of action here. So this is the action of looking after life and not destroying or damaging life. The second of these courses of action is stealing, and the opposite is generosity. I'm not going to talk about that today, because that's also a very big topic. The third one of the bodily actions is sexual misconduct. And this is actually an important one. This is actually a very interesting one. So I want to talk a little bit about this today. One of the things which is fascinating about this rule of abstaining from sexual misconduct is that it is one of those rules which is quite relative. It depends on what sort of society you live in, how this rule should be applied. And I will give you a very obvious example. At the time of the Buddha, society was quite different from what it is today. And particularly women had a very different position in society. And that reflects itself in this particular rule of sexual misconduct. When you read about this rule in the suttas, what the Buddha taught about this, it says that it is sexual, is only sexual misconduct if a man has a sexual relationship with a wife of another man. In other words, if he has a relationship with another woman who is not the wife of another man, but he is unfaithful to his own wife, that seems to have been no problem at the time of the Buddha. And you can see why, because in those days you had polygamy, men would have many wives, and it was just a very different social situation. So a woman was, in a sense, used to the idea that a man was not supposed to be faithful. So in that circumstance, it was considered that there wasn't so much suffering to that woman, presumably, that there was a rule laid down against adultery. But, of course, in today's society, things have changed dramatically. And in today, we certainly wouldn't see any difference between adultery, whether it's by a man or a woman. It doesn't make any difference anymore. And today, the hurt both ways is basically the same. So for that reason, we go back to the basic principle we started off with the beginning. And we ask ourselves, is it going to hurt anybody? Is it going to hurt myself or somebody else? And we know straight away that because the hurt is basically the same, this rule applies in today's society in the same way for men and women. And adultery in any way comes under this rule. So this rule is one of the few rules which is socially conditioned, and it depends on the society that you are in. Another example of this, I was asked some time ago by somebody about what about premarital sex? Is that acceptable in Buddhism? And I think the answer there again is it depends on the society that you live in. There are some societies when it is looked down upon as something terrible, something incredibly wrong, and your family will be really shamed and feel terrible if you did such a thing. And because of the amount of suffering that you are inducing into your family in these societies, I would say yes, in these cases it is immoral, it is wrong to have premarital sexual relationships. It is not right. But in a society where it is generally accepted that when you reach a certain age, what exactly that age is obviously up for debate, but say that when you're 25 or something, generally at least, you are expected to be able to be your own boss. And you basically decide, and everybody accepts that you're your own boss. And because of that, I would say that in those cases, no, it's not wrong to have premarital sexual relationships as long as you feel confident that you're not really hurting anybody else. So again, it comes back to this thing, who are we hurting? Are we hurting ourselves or are we hurting somebody else? And you can also apply this rule of this basic kind of moral principle, you can apply it to all kinds of sexual activity. I mean, sometimes we hear about people who do all kinds of sexual activities, which most people don't. And sometimes people disapprove of those things. And the question is, are these things immoral? I don't think there's any point in going into details, but are what one might call different sexual preferences, is it wrong? And the answer is, again, you go back to the same principle. Are we hurting anybody? Are we hurting myself? Are we hurting somebody else? And that is how you decide in these cases. And very often you will find that nobody is hurting anybody, in which case it is acceptable. It is okay. It may not be absolutely perfect, but it's not bad enough to really have a clear-cut rule against it at the very least. So that is a bit on this idea of sexual morality, which is the last of the courses of unwholesome action in the threefold scheme I'm talking about here, the 10 courses of action. And before I move on to speech, I'm going to talk a little bit about alcohol, because alcohol is another interesting area, I find. And as I said before, these lists that the Buddha gave of the 5 precepts, they are not random. And because they're not random, there is a significance to the fact that alcohol comes at the bottom of this list. The significance is, of course, that alcohol in its own right is not that morally reprehensible compared to the other 4 precepts. It comes, that's why it comes last. But of course, the problem with alcohol is that when you are under its influence, it's very easy to do things which are immoral, and that's precisely why it is a part of the 5 precepts. But there's more to alcohol than that, and there are a few things in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha, that he said about alcohol, which I found very fascinating when I first read it. And one of those important things about alcohol, which I found, was that he said that alcohol is something you can never have enough of. There is no satiation point with alcohol. There is no final satisfaction. You always want more and more and more. And so you create a habit maybe of drinking maybe just a glass of wine a day, and you think, well, what can be wrong with drinking a glass of wine a day? And indeed, it's not really going to have any effect on your moral conduct, or at least very, very small effect. But the point is, you're creating a habit, and that habit is going to increase, and generally speaking, will tend to lead to more and more drinking over time. And when I say over time here, of course, from a Buddhist point of view, it doesn't just mean this lifetime. We're talking about many lifetimes. And that is what makes it so much more powerful. So you can actually create a habit which goes on from one life. You will bring a habit that you create very strongly in this life. You will bring it into future lives as well. So this habit that you make of drinking alcohol, which may seem very insignificant and small now, in life after life, it can become worse and worse. And slowly and slowly, you can actually become very serious after a while. So habits are dangerous, because habits are precisely the things that we carry from one life to the next. And this is one reason why alcohol is dangerous. the lack of satisfaction, the fact that we always will tend to drink a little bit more the day after compared to the day before, and the fact that we bring the habits across with us from life after life. And the other thing, on top of this, which the Buddha said, which makes it so dangerous, is that the karmic effect of drinking, the Buddha said, is ultimately madness. It is some distortions of the mind, basically. And of course, this is not going to happen at the very early stages of drinking, but certainly when it becomes a very serious habit, that's when madness comes into its place. And we all know that. We all know that if somebody is a very, very serious drinker of alcohol, if they try to stop, they will have all kinds of hallucinations, all kinds of things happening to them, to the point where they actually go insane. So here, again, you see this danger of slowly increasing your abuse, slowly getting worse, until it can actually lead to something as traumatic as this. And I think it is a fair reason to suppose that many of those people who have serious mental illnesses in our society, like schizophrenia, or maybe even manic depression and these sort of things, may actually be the result of alcohol abuse or drug abuse, serious drug abuse, from a past life. Because it tends, if you get too much of it, it can lead to this sense of madness. Okay, so that is the five precepts, basically. And the bodily actions, the three bodily actions. And now we come on to speech. And speech is another fascinating area. I'm going to talk a bit more briefly about this. There is four types of speech conduct taught by the Buddha. These four in brief are lying. They are divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle gossip. These are the four areas which the Buddha focused on. These are the four wrong areas. And the opposite, of course, is the truth-telling, speech which creates harmony, speech which is gentle, and speech which is meaningful rather than idle gossip. I'm going to skip lying, and I'm going to go straight on to this idea of divisive speech or harmonious speech. And what the Buddha said here is that this sort of speech is when you hear something somewhere, you go to somebody else and tell them what you heard. Or you go from the first group or the second group and back to the first group and tell them what they were saying. So you create a rift. You create like a split between these people because they hear bad things about each other. And more broadly, this sort of thing is whenever we say something bad about somebody to somebody else, we are essentially creating divisions. We are creating negativity because we are planting a seed there. It always has an influence on somebody when we say something negative about somebody. People always listen to these things. And even though they may not take you 100% seriously, it always has some effect. So there's always a sense of divisiveness there. We divide people apart. And that is why this is such an important principle of speech, not to speak divisively, not to talk about others' bad sides, certainly not at the wrong time, and certainly not from the wrong intentions of ill will or irritation or whatever it may be. And the opposite of the divisive speech is speech which creates harmony. When we talk about the positive qualities of somebody else, when we go to say to somebody, you know, this person said something very nice about you, and we tell them what the other person said about them. And this creates a goodwill because these people will then tend to bond together because there's a sense of mutual appreciation there, a sense of mutual that they have an understanding and appreciation for each other. So whenever you say something which is positive, that creates harmony, that creates bonds between people, this is good karma. This is good way of speaking. And it is actually very highly praised by the Buddha. Again, you can use this hierarchy I'm talking about. False speech is the worst one, but the second worst one of speech is divisive speech. So it is quite a bad, quite a serious way of speaking. And Of course, this is how we can create bonds, and this is how a place like the Buddhist Society, of course, also becomes stronger. This is how groups bond together, and the Buddhist Society being a group. It is how we bond together in the Buddhist Society when we see the positive things in each other, and we talk about those positive things to each other. Then the bonds are created. The third aspect of speech here is harsh speech. And harsh speech is, of course, speech which is painful, which is tough, which is kind of doesn't resonate with us. It's not nice. It's not necessarily divisive, but it is like a speech. We all know what harsh speech is, basically. And the opposite of harsh speech is speech which is gentle, which is soft. And it says in the sutta, speech which goes to the heart, which is pleasing to the ear, and which is pleasing to the ordinary people. Whenever an ordinary person hears this speech, they will feel delighted by it. They will feel happy by it. And an important aspect of this beautiful speech called gentle speech and nice speech is that it leads to good meditation. Harsh speech, it is said in the suttas, leads in the opposite way. It leads away from samadhi, away from meditation. So harsh speech is going to take you away if you are a keen meditator, whereas a gentle speech is going to move you towards meditation, towards something positive in that area. So that is quite interesting, I find, because obviously if we are serious about meditation, this sort of thing is an important piece or information to motivate us to keep this particular precept, if you like. And I also notice very often that the sort of person who is often popular, the sort of person who people want to listen to in life, who maybe sometimes even become the center of attention, is not necessarily somebody who is interesting or who has a good story. A good story is, of course, important as well. But very often it is a person who is gentle and says things in a nice way so that people actually feel comfortable around them. This is often a very attractive character trait in people. And we can see how people flock around people who have that particular character trait. There is actually there's an interesting place in the suttas which talks about something called the grounds for kindness, or the grounds for, almost like the grounds for forming groups. And one of those grounds for forming like a group and group cohesion and forming a group of people around you is precisely kindly speech. It's one of those grounds. The other grounds for that is giving a helping hand when it's needed, generosity, and equal treatment of people. These are the four things which are called as grounds for sympathy, which like creates groups around you, which like makes you a popular person almost if you have these grounds of sympathy. But anyway, I'm getting a bit sidetracked now. So harsh speech, if you want to meditate well, is not advisable. The last type of speech, which was not recommended by the Buddha, is idle chatter. In other words, speech which doesn't have any particular meaning, where you're not really talking about anything useful, anything which is going to lead to anything beneficial, whether it's Dhamma or whether it's beneficial in a more worldly sense. So the positive side of speech here is speech which is meaningful, which is goes to make people happy, which goes to preaching of the Dhamma. And very beautifully said in this particular sutta, speech which is worthy of being treasured, speech which you can heap up in your mind and store in your mind, this is a sort of speech that we should be uttering here. So, of course, this is very idealistic, and it's almost impossible to only talk about Dhamma all the time. People think you're nuts if you talk about that all the time. And particularly if you are, you know, if you have people who are not Buddhist, and they may think you're going over the top. So, of course, we shouldn't push that sort of issue too far, and there are times when we have to be friendly. And it's fascinating in the suttas that the Buddha, whenever he started off, for example, a conversation with somebody, particularly somebody he didn't know, there was always like courteous and amiable talk in the beginning. Always like an exchange of kindness beforehand. How are you? I hope you're well. I hope you're not suffering. How are your children? And how is your wife or husband? I hope your new job, the Buddha didn't go this far, but this is sort of things which are obviously positive. I hope you're enjoying your new job, etc. And so this is important. So we shouldn't become completely silent, mute, if we're not talking about the Dhamma. There's always a place for kindness and friendliness there. And of course, a lot of things in the life is about practicalities. When we have a job, etc., or even in the monastery, we also have work. You have to talk about practicalities, and these obviously are important things. But we also, no doubt, have times when we know that we are saying things which really are not really very useful and are just purely idle chatter without any kind of meaning whatsoever. What is the problem with all this idle chatter? Why does the Buddha say we should avoid this sort of thing? Yeah? And the first thing is simply that the more you talk, the more stuff comes out of your mouth, the more likely you are to say things which are also bad in other ways. Say things which are maybe harsh, which are divisive. Even lies can come out. The more you talk, the less mindfulness you tend to have. And the more things come out which you wish shouldn't come out in the first place. And this is one reason why it's good to not talk too much, not have too much idle chatter. And the other reason, of course, is that if you talk a lot on topics which are not useful, your mind becomes very active. There's a lot of stuff going on in there. And of course, again, if you're serious about your meditation practice, this is a sort of thing you really want to avoid because it activates the mind. So these are basically the reasons why idle chatter is something which is to be avoided if one is going to be very serious about right speech in Buddhism. So these are the four aspects of right speech. I talked about only three of them. And I think they are interesting because they're not talked about all that often. And they do actually have an effect on our moral practice and the way we live our moral life. Now, the last factors of morality here is the morality of the mind. And now we are coming basically to morality which really only affects ourselves. And this is the case where we do these things because we want to be kind to ourselves. But take anger, for example. As long as you don't express that anger outwardly in body or speech, it's basically only you who get hurt by this anger. So in this case, you shouldn't be angry because it hurts yourself. Also, you shouldn't be angry, of course, because if you are angry, sooner or later it will come out through body or speech. I'm not going to talk about anger today because I gave a talk a few weeks ago here at length about overcoming anger. But the second factor here is greed. Greed is a second factor of mind, which is to be avoided as unwholesome. And the opposite here is like being contented or even being generous. This is the opposite thing of greed here. And we all know what greed actually here in the Pali is a word which means more like covetousness, desiring things which you don't already have. And we all know what that can be like. You can go shopping, for example. You see all these things in the shopping window. That would be really nice. That would be incredibly nice to have. Now, how can I get that? I can't really afford it, but maybe I can get hold of it somehow. And then this idea that we need something takes over the agenda completely and becomes the focus of things. Not only that, but it tends to excite the mind. If you're greedy, if you really want something, it excites the mind. It makes the mind very like agitated in a sense. And of course, again, it's very clear that this sort of agitation in the mind is something which goes against meditation practice. This is like a very basic thing, this thing about greed and covetousness, this idea of craving being an agitation in mind. It's a very common topic in Buddhism, of course. So instead of when we see this, when we understand that there is a danger in these things, we can also understand the advantage of just being contented with what we already have. And looking at our possessions and asking ourselves, well, have I actually got enough? This is, of course, very difficult. And there will always be times when we haven't got enough, when we need something else. But generally speaking, if we can be contented with what we already have, if we can be satisfied with what we have already, then we don't give rise to so much excitement when we see something out there in the world. We don't give rise to so much greed for things that we don't already own. And as we all know, if you have a sense of contentment, it makes meditation practice so much easier. contentment is like one of the most important factors to make meditation peaceful and nice. Ajahn Brahm talks about it all the time. And in my experience, it is also very true that when you have a sense of contentment, it makes the mind automatically more peaceful. And it makes for much better meditation practice. So of course, this is obviously another difficult one. But it's worth noticing what happens with your mind and how your mind is distorted by these things and how it takes it away from peace. And then we can maybe increase our sense of contentment, our sense of satisfaction with those things that we already have. And it will be obviously to our own benefit a great deal. So that is the second factor of mental conduct, is to try to overcome the sense of greed. And the last factor of good mental conduct or bad mental conduct is right or wrong view. Right view is good mental conduct and wrong view is bad mental conduct. I'm actually not going to talk about this at all, but I wasn't going to talk about this at all, but very briefly, obviously if you have wrong view and really, really wrong view, then what that means is that you don't really think that there's anything bad about being immoral, for example. You don't think it really affects anybody else. And certainly you don't think it affects you personally. So immorality is acceptable. That is the really sort of the wrong view, having gone completely berserk. And then you have been for some serious troubles, according to Buddhism, because of the laws of karma and the results that you can expect from that sort of action. So to maybe summarize very briefly, what I think maybe the most important thing I wanted to say tonight is simply that if we ever have doubts about whether something is moral or immoral, we have this beautiful teaching of the Buddha. Look at whether it's going to hurt anybody. Is it going to hurt yourself? Is it going to hurt anybody else? And from this basic premise, we can make so many decisions in life about whether something is right or wrong. But don't wait and make those decisions. Don't wait to think about these questions until you are actually in a particular situation. Because once you're in a situation, you can often be overcome by maybe negativity or desire. And these things will distort your perception of what is right and what is wrong, and what hurts people and what doesn't. Make up your principles of what is right and wrong, if you want to make them up. When you feel your mind is clear and you can think clearly about what is actually going on here. And this is the most important thing. And also, the second thing, which is really important, I feel, is that morality is not something which is just negative. It's not something that we just have to stop ourselves from doing. But there's a positive aspect of morality, the opposite. And that is what we should actively be pursuing in life. The opposite of the negative qualities, the generosity, the kindness, the beautiful speech to other people. And even the beautiful mental conduct that we are practicing. And all these things, of course, are part of the practice of being Buddhists, or certainly at the very least being interested in this Buddhist path. So that is all I really want to say tonight. I don't know if people have any questions or comments or anything. So this is a time to ask you. Yes, sir.
If there is injustice and inequality in the world, what is the way to change that view in someone? Because if you just show loving kindness to someone when there's inequality and injustice, is there not a time to feel anger and righteousness?
I don't think anger is ever very useful. And the reason it isn't useful is because, as I said before, it distorts your mind. Once you feel anger, you're very likely to do things that later on you will regret. So what you should do in those instances, instead of actually getting angry, you should ask yourself, what can I do to change this? Is there anything I can do to change it? And then do whatever you can to change these things. Anger is not going to be helpful, because if you get angry and your perception gets distorted, you're actually likely to do things which are going to be worse than if you think clearly about the situation and do whatever result you come to when you think clearly about it. So anger is never useful. But of course, we should do things. And one of the really difficult things about this sort of thing is that you actually have to do it with a sense of equanimity. You have to say, well, okay, I'm going to go into the situation. There's some serious injustice here. I want to help out. I want to do something here. But if you go into that situation with too much craving that you are going to succeed, then you will get very disappointed if it doesn't work. You will get frustrated, and then you will get angry anyway. You know what I mean? So what you have to do there is that you actually have to try to go into that situation and say, well, I may fail. And if I fail, I'm just going to have to let go. I'm just going to have to accept that there is going to be injustice in the world. I will never be able to solve everything. I can try to help out. If I don't succeed, so be it. That is ideally the right attitude. Of course, getting to that ideal is not easy, but at least you have something there to measure yourself against. Are you happy with that answer? Okay. Yeah. Anybody else want to say anything? Yeah. Yes, over there. Yeah, that's a very interesting question. It's a very good question, I think. Yeah. And I think the answer there it's very difficult to really give a very clear answer to that sort of questions, because these are very gray areas. Yeah. And in fact, to get an understanding of this question, it's quite useful to consider the way that the Buddha taught about karma in the suttas. The way he taught about karma is that there's three types of karma. There is white karma with white results. And the white karma with white results is like when you have a completely pure mind with no hindrances, like you come out of the most profound meditation states. Your mind is clean as a white sheet, or whatever you want to call it. Then the karma that you're producing is completely white. You get reborn in an exclusively happy realm. But then there is karma which is black and white and reaps black and white results, right? And I think what you're talking about now is precisely one of these karmas which are black and white and reap black and white results. Because you can be motivated by compassion towards these people, by really profound compassion. You see so much suffering because of this malaria. But at the same time, there is something in you which then also wants to kill these mosquitoes. So there is a mixture there of intentions and motivation. Your motivation is reasonably pure because you come through compassion, but your intention is still to kill those mosquitoes. And the karmic result of that sort of action tends to be black and white. And for that reason, it is not as pure and not as wholesome as a purely white action. So I think that if you are going to aim for the absolutely highest, then you wouldn't actually be killing those mosquitoes. You actually wouldn't do that. You wouldn't actually be able to have the intention even to kill those mosquitoes. If somebody asked you an opinion, you would maybe say something like, you know, you would maybe say what I said now, what the Buddha said in the sutta, as a different type of action, and then they would have to decide from themselves what they would do from that point. But if you really have pure action, you cannot kill. You would never condemn, of course, anybody who did the killing. You would say, well, this is your decision, and if you feel it's right, you must do it. But I think the highest kind of morality, you actually wouldn't do that. It's hard to understand, maybe. But as I see it, that is actually the highest type of morality there. Yes, Gina. Okay, there's actually two more karmas, actually. I only said three, but there's actually four. And the fourth one is the black karma with black results. That is the one you really want to avoid. And that is when your mind is completely overcome by anger or by greed or by something. Absolutely. And your action is completely motivated by that and nothing else. And that is a sort of action which leads to great suffering in the future. The last type of karma, which the Buddha also taught, and this is even more difficult to understand, this is the karma which is neither black and white and has neither black and white results. And this is the karma which basically is only possible for somebody who is almost enlightened or on the way to enlightenment, whereby you are no longer concerned at all with happiness and suffering. All you're concerned about is getting to Nibbana. That is the action which leads to neither black and white result, because it leads to Nibbana. Yeah.
So the merely enlightened being
No, certainly not. Neither black and white does not mean that you are beyond it, so to speak. It just means it's a different kind of karma altogether. It's like white. It's like neither black and white on top of white, if you like. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Anybody else got anything to say here? I can't see. Yeah, please, sir. Yes. Right. Yeah, it's true. And it is basically the if you live as a human being, you're going to kill enormous amounts of beings during this lifetime. It is absolutely unavoidable that you're going to kill enormous amounts of beings. Think about how many beings it gets killed just to feed you. Even if you're a vegetarian, how many beings get killed in those fields of, you know, where you plant vegetables or where you plant cereals or whatever it is? Enormous amounts of beings get killed. So just by existing, just by walking out of this hall this afternoon, I'm sure you're going to kill about 5 ants before you get to your car. You know what I mean? It's just impossible. Life is just full of this. And that is why it is, in a sense, so sad, this life, because it involves so much killing. It involves so much suffering. Even if you are perfectly pure arahat, full enlightened person, you're still going to kill a large number of beings. So it is unavoidable. Samsara is like that. And this is one of the reasons why this place called samsara is so unpleasant, in a sense. And it's so full of suffering. So when I come here tonight, I realize that. I'm fully aware that all these beings are going to be killed. But I certainly don't have an intention to kill these beings. I don't come here with the thought, aha, if I come here, I will kill all these beings. Great. That is not my thought. I come here because I have basically been invited to give this talk. Ajahn Brahm asked me, can you go and give a talk at the Buddhist Society? And that's why I come here. So my intention is pure. And as long as your intention is pure, as long as you're coming from a wholesome motive, then there is no bad action, there is no bad karma, and for that reason, there is no bad result of that in the future. But if I were to squash an ant intentionally, of course, that is where the bad karma comes in. It is your intention which is the important factor here, not actually whether a being dies or not. Yes, sir. You mean in the case of unintentional killing, or yeah? Well, if you kill intentionally, then I would say remorse is often a good thing, because remorse means that you will restrain yourself in the future. And in fact, the Buddha even said, he went so far as to say that if you do something which is unwholesome, there is a natural tendency for the mind to feel remorse. This is not something that you really can control. It will come up by itself. You don't have to sort of decide, I will feel remorse or not. It will come up on its own. So because of that natural tendency, you will find that you're destroying your chances of meditation, because your mind will be filled with remorse when you actually want to meditate. But when it comes to unintentional killing, there's no reason why you should try to bring up remorse in your mind, because you can't avoid that. If you sort of bring up remorse and sadness, you can bring up maybe a bit of sadness, because it will propel you to practice more and get out of this thing called samsara. But don't sort of whip yourself because you're unintentionally killing a living being, because you're going to be doing that for the rest of your life, and becomes like self-torture in a sense. So unintentional killing, don't make that a big deal. Of course, if you can avoid killing a living being and you want to be compassionate, great. But very often we just can't avoid it. In those cases, don't make a big deal out of it. Okay. Sorry. Okay, at the back there. Sure. Yeah. Right. Well, you have to just tell yourself that First of all, you just have to accept that you're going to get angry sometimes. There's no point in saying that you know, I shouldn't feel this. This is wrong. And again, being really hard on yourself. That's no point. You have to be kind to yourself. You have to realize your own human weaknesses sometimes and accept yourself. Accept everything in you, including your anger. Be kind to yourself. This is like a basic Buddhist principle. But at the same time, you should also realize that these things are unwholesome and that they lead to your own suffering. So don't make it worse by criticizing yourself, but instead think to yourself, well, how can I look at this situation differently? Is there something I can do to make this different? That is the way to look at it. There's so many things you can do. You can try to understand where the other person is coming from, why they are saying these negative things. Very often, maybe they've had a bad day, or they've had some difficult thing happening in their life, or they just are habitually angry. They are somebody who suffers all the time, maybe. Or you can reflect that somebody who does something bad to you, well, they will be caught by the laws of karma, and they will get enormous suffering as a result of whatever badness they do. I'm not going to say too much because I gave a long talk on anger just a few weeks ago. If you're interested, it's actually on the website. You can just go and listen to it. But there are many things and many strategies you can use to overcome anger. And I think there are many books in the library, probably many talks that have been given on that particular subject.
Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namah.